You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, salad doesn't always get the credit it deserves. There are a lot more possibilities than the simple lettuce and tomato and cheese and dressing combo. We'll hear how to spice up our salad game from a local farmer coming up next. First, Democrats introduced a resolution last week known as the Green New Deal, a far-ranging set of proposals aimed at combating climate change. It wouldn't have the power to create any new programs if passed, but its backers are calling it an important step in making the U.S. a carbon-neutral country. Senator Ed Markey of Massachusetts sponsored the resolution along with Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez from New York. Here she is speaking at a press conference last week.
Climate change and our environmental challenges are one of the biggest existential threats to our way of life. Not just as a nation, but as a world. And in order for us to combat that threat, we must be as ambitious and innovative in our solution as possible.
Mark Pocan is a Democrat representing Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District, which includes Madison. He's also co-chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. We talked with him earlier today. Representative Pocan, thanks for joining us.
Oh, very glad to.
Well, the Green New Deal, this resolution covers a lot of ground. Can you tell us what you see as the most important parts of it?
Well, I think the most important part is that it is elevating the conversation about climate change like we have not had before. It's talking about how do you rapidly address climate change. We've had several reports in the last year that told us we may be past the point of no return, and that figuring out every aspect of it so that we can be ready to transition to an economy that focuses on renewables. So I think it's the big picture concept that we need to act now, and that while it doesn't lay out explicit ways to do that, it lays out the process that we need to follow in order to figure out how to get to that goal.
Now, it's a tall order in some ways, and it calls for things having to do with labor rights, employment for Americans, universal health care, a lot of things people might see as social issues. Does that dilute the scope of the focus on climate change?
I think people who want to dilute the focus on climate change will focus on different aspects like that. But what it's trying to do is be honest. You know, if we wind up transitioning to, as we should, renewables as our major energy sources, you're going to have a displacement of jobs in people who work in fossil fuel industries. So you have to address that. So really, it's being honest with the American people, which is something that isn't generally done in Washington. So I think that's what surprises people. And people try to focus on little side portions rather than the major part of it, again, which is how do we transition to that renewable energy system in the country, and what are all the other aspects from health to employment and other issues that are going to be touched by it. I think that's what it's trying to do, and then, of course, the detractors are trying to use that to distract.
This would take a lot of effort from the government, and that's what some critics are pointing toward. Instead of trying to incentivize market changes that reduce carbon emissions, things like carbon taxes, do you think that's a valid criticism?
Well, I think this is looking at the model of, you know, when we put a person on the moon, we made a serious effort from government to do just that. And we invested a lot in space exploration, and out of that, a lot of other developments came in. We're saying, why wouldn't you do the same thing that's really threatening the future of the planet? By making a serious focus and investment on it, you also provide savings and all the other things that we spend money on that people may not directly put to energy costs. There's a big reason that we so often are in wars in the Middle East. It's because of oil. And if you can find ways to address all those other aspects that come out of our current way that we do energy, you're going to have all types of savings. So this is just trying to have a big picture. Interestingly, I had a hearing last week, Rob, that I thought was really interesting, where we still spend about 3 times the amount of money on research on space than we do on energy in this country. So we already are still at a pittance of where we should be, and this is just trying to make us put a much stronger focus on that.
Now, this is a resolution. Do you see pieces of this that could become legislation in the near future?
Well, I think there's a number of ways this is going to happen. First of all, there's a Democratic majority now, and a number of committees that have jurisdiction over the climate are doing activities right now, taking up bills and having subcommittees meet and having hearings. Secondly, there's now a special committee on climate change that's been formed by Nancy Pelosi, and that's going to be meeting. And then third, you've got this resolution with lots of different diverse sponsors, and what other aspects come out of this. So the good news is there are multiple fronts where we're seeing activity happen on climate change that have not occurred, at least since I've been in Congress, and I think that's a very positive note.
Do you see legislation being possible that could pass the Democratic-controlled House and a Republican-controlled Senate?
Yeah, I think there should be. I mean, this shouldn't be a left-right spectrum issue. I think where generally we hit some barriers are when special interests are affected. So clearly, the oil and gas industry, the fossil fuel industry doesn't like this because they want to continue making the profits that they're making right now. So, you know, in some cases, we may lose some Democratic support, but we certainly should also be able to pick up some Republican support. This is looking at the future of the country and making sure that we're not involved in every single altercation in the Middle East and in other places because of oil. This is really trying to look forward and figure out how to take care of those energy sources where the money stays in the United States. And I think that's the real focus. And if we do that, I think there should be support in both parties.
Talking to Mark Pocan, Democrat representing Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District, looking at the Green New Deal. We'll touch on the shutdown in just a few moments. Supporters of fossil fuels in the United States might say, hey, we're producing a lot of natural gas, more and more oil here in the United States. We have great domestic sources of these now. Does that take the concerns over, say, Middle Eastern oil off the table?
No, not at all. First of all, we have certain types of oil. For the heavier type of crude, we still have to get that from other places. And one of those places is Venezuela, where currently there's unrest and the president's threatening military intervention. I don't know if we'd be doing that if it wasn't an oil-producing country. So there are still a lot of reasons why continuing to rely on fossil fuels doesn't make sense, even if we do have some increased production. Let's also understand it's a finite source. We need to be focusing on wind and solar and biomass and other ways that you can continue to have energy produced quite less costly, but there is some cost to get it up to the capacity it needs to provide that kind of energy. You know, I myself have 8.5 kilowatts of solar on our roof. I've had bills as low as $7. There's something really special about a $7 bill. But the sun is always going to be there, and wind is always going to be there, and we need to really focus on those types of energy for the future.
Do you see, before we move on to the shutdown, do you see the momentum changing when it comes to tackling climate change?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, just seeing the majority change, you know, you're instantly, it's a conversation. And with the new people that came to Congress, it's a priority conversation. And when you look at, again, public opinion polls around the country, cross sections of almost every political demographic have strong support for this. So, again, people get this. It's the special interests that generally are fighting it in Washington. They want to keep the profits they've always had. We just have to keep our eye on the future of the country, not the future of special interests.
All right, turning to the news today, and this is a moving target, but negotiations underway. A tentative deal, it sounds like, has been reached on a spending bill that would avoid a shutdown that would start this weekend. Some funding for border security, not everything the president wants. What do you think? What do you make of the current state of affairs?
Well, we're waiting to see. I saw a little bit of the president over the noon hour, and boy, I've never seen someone offer a more confusing press conference, but I guess he does that fairly often. You know, he was on both sides of the issue, as we expected. That's probably going to wait to see if a few Fox hosts have a positive or negative opinion on this for where he falls. But, you know, as I understand the deal and has not been shared with us yet, we've seen just the news accounts and waiting to see what the White House is going to do. It still does not provide money for a wall. It does continue to provide some money, as we've had in past appropriation bills, for other ways of doing border protection. But it does not have money explicitly for a wall. And yet we also didn't get things we wanted to do, to have fewer detention beds, because, you know, that also is extremely costly, both in human terms and in other terms. So, you know, part of a compromise is not everyone's happy about everything, but the White House is going to have to let us know where they're at on this. I think to some degree he likes having debates over continuing resolutions, because as long as we're doing that, we're not talking about the Mueller report. We're not talking about Michael Cohen flipping. We're not talking about all of his other staff that have been indicted. I think there may be a media strategy that the president has to to what he's doing on this.
And I wanted to ask about investigations of the president now that there's a Democratic majority. What kind of investigations and what level of investigations are you hoping to see?
You know, there's definitely a lot of investigations finally happening in Congress. The last 2 years when Paul Ryan was Speaker, we did nothing. Zero oversight for a co-equal branch of government, and that was extremely disappointing. So now it's finally happening, so there's a lot of pent-up work that needs to happen. There are some major committees that will look at various aspects of this administration, and then a lot of other committees looking at deeper dives into some of the specific proposals and policy that's been enacted by the various agencies in this administration. So we're finally doing the job as a co-equal branch of government. It's been much overdue, and hopefully we'll get some good answers for the American people.
Representative Pocan, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
Mark Pocan is a Democrat representing Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District. He's the co-chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. We talked to him earlier today. Coming up, most of us should probably eat more vegetables. We'll find out how to make a satisfying meal out of salad. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, if Wisconsin produced all of the energy it uses in-state, what would that mean for the economy? We'll talk to the authors of a new report on Wisconsin's energy alternatives. First, a lot of us might use salad as a light start to a meal or maybe as a side dish, but our next guest says salad can be the star of the show. She has recipes for salads that can provide a substantial meal and feel as hearty as anything else you might want to put on your plate. Do you love making salads or throwing something together from what's in your fridge? Do you want to share some ideas for your go-to salad? Maybe you've got a surprising salad add-on you want to share. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Lauren Rudersdorf owns and operates Raleigh's Hillside Farm outside of Evansville with her husband Kyle. She shares stories and recipes on her blog, The Leek and the Carrot, and writes for Edible Madison and Madison Magazine. Lauren, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, nice to be here.
Well, I understand, I mean, a lot of people like salad, but you really like salad. Can you tell us about your love for salad?
Yeah, well, I think it comes easily after 6 years of growing organic vegetables for a living, but that's kind of where my salad story begins. My husband and I started a farm, Raleigh's Hillside Farm, together in 2013, and we do CSA style of agriculture, so we grow a diversity of vegetables to give to our customers or members every week, and there happens to be a lot of greens in there, and especially in the spring, we're giving people lettuce and kale and bok choy and cabbage and we really felt like it was kind of our responsibility if we were going to give people so many greens and so many vegetables that we needed to learn how to love them. So we started making salads at home regularly, and all of a sudden we realized they could be the fun thing before the meal, or they really could be the whole meal with enough work. So I started to really be a little obsessed, and I have a lot of fun with especially salad recipes and green hearty recipes on my blog.
Now, you gave us some recipes to share. We've got them at WPR.org. A common theme in a lot of your recipes and other kind of hearty salad recipes is not so much on the romaine and green leaf and iceberg and whatever. You're using some heavier greens that I might want to cook first. Why are we using some things like the kales and the cabbages and the Brussels sprouts?
I think especially when you are making such a hearty salad, if you're putting something hot on there, like a lot of times I'll put roasted vegetables, like roasted winter squash or sweet potatoes or carrots. Sometimes I'll put rotisserie chicken. I'll shred it up and throw that on top of my salad. When you're putting warm things like that on a salad, romaine can stand up to it okay, but a lot of traditional lettuces are just going to kind of wilt down in a way that isn't very appealing. So if you're doing a nice kind of thick dressing and some of those hot toppings, something like collards that are shredded really, really finely, kale that's shredded really finely, cabbage, even Brussels sprouts, things that you don't traditionally think of as salad greens, if you cut them thinly and put something warm on top, they just kind of all blend together and they'll hold up. You can dress them, put them in your fridge and eat them for 3 days and they won't wilt too much. That's kind of where I started enjoying those greens. We really prep cook a lot in our house. We'll make huge batches of things, and it felt like it felt like those heartier greens kind of stood up to that kind of batch cooking technique a little better, which is where I started with that.
Now, I came across a technique, and it's in at least one of your recipes that I was unfamiliar with, taking the kale and massaging it.
Yeah. That's actually a pretty, it's becoming a more common technique with greens, especially like kale and collards, because they are so, they're so fibrous, they're so thick. So you can put some olive oil on them, some salt on them, and that's not your dressing. You just drizzle a little bit of each on there. And, yeah, you really just kind of massage the greens that are already cut up with your hands until they almost start to break down. So they'll almost look like they're cooked. They won't break down quite that much. But, yeah, just enough that they can really stand up to whatever you put on them.
We are talking about salad as the star of a meal and making heartier salads that can be a meal. Lauren Rudersdorf is with us with Raleigh's Hillside Farm near Evansville, Wisconsin. Lauren, let's check out one of the recipes you shared with us. We've got it at WPR.org. We mentioned Brussels sprouts. You've got a spicy Brussels sprouts with peanuts and apples. Tell us about this one.
Yeah, so this is one of those ones using a heartier green that you wouldn't even necessarily think of as a salad green. We had a lot of Brussels sprouts left over from the fall, and now that it's February, I was getting pretty sick of just roasting all my vegetables and not having anything that tasted like fresh and light. So I took those Brussels sprouts, I trimmed the ends off, and then I sliced them very, very thinly, maybe an eighth of an inch thick. So that's probably the most time-consuming part of the recipe. So once I shredded them, then I tossed them with some apples and some peanuts. I threw a really quick, simple dressing together that was sesame oil, vinegar, tamari, fish sauce, a little bit of maple syrup, and some red pepper flakes. Whisked that together and kind of just drizzled it over the top. Let it sit and marinate for maybe just 3-4 minutes, again, because it's a hearty green, to just really let the dressing soak in. And yeah, it was lovely and bright, and you forgot it was winter for a second.
And you have kind of a formula for salads. You start maybe with some kind of green, maybe a heavier green that we've been talking about, and then you add in some other things. Let's start with something crunchy. What do you like to turn to add some crunch?
Yeah, so that Brussels sprout salad is really kind of my key formula, because you'll see there it's got a nut, it's got something crunchy, it's got an apple, it's got something sweet, and then it's got those red pepper flakes that are going to add a little bit of bite to it. So those are kind of my main three after I have the greens. I want something crunchy, so nuts are probably my most common go-to and the easiest thing to just stack in my pantry. You know, I've got pecans, walnuts, pepitas, peanuts, kind of a little bit of all those, so whatever flavor profile I'm going with, I can throw some nuts on. Another fun thing I did in one of these recipes that I shared with you is I fried up some shallots, and I threw those on top for my crunchy element. That's a little more work, but absolutely delicious. Croutons are obviously a really well-known crunchy element. Seeds, radishes, other raw vegetables can be a really nice crunch. And then, yeah, for the sweet things, obviously fruit. Fruit I love to put on my salads. Apples are my go-to this time of year, but again, like dried fruit, any like dried cherries, dried cranberries, we have tons of those in Wisconsin. It's citrus season, so having segments of blood orange or pear on there could be really beautiful. And then for bite is kind of the optional add-on. I think the crunchy and the sweet are the essentials, but some pickled veg or some red pepper flakes or some raw shallots or something that just have a little bit of just a little pop, it'll really kind of bring your salad to the next level.
Now let's talk about dressing. For a more substantial salad, you want to skip the light vinaigrette. What kind of dressings do you go to?
So it depends on the salad. Sometimes I'm in a hurry and I just want to eat a salad quickly. And then, you know, I've got my favorites, like the Annie's brand of balsamic dressing is a really hearty, delicious dressing. I really love the Brianna's brand of buttermilk ranch. But if you've got some time and you're okay with, you know, adding that 5 minutes to make your own dressing, I make my own maple balsamic. That's what I put on the cabbage salad with squash, beets, and rotisserie chicken. And that, it doesn't even feel that heavy. It's just a little more decadent because you make it at home. There's maple syrup in there. There's Dijon in there. There's a lot of balsamic vinegar and olive oil, a little salt and pepper, some garlic. And that really, again, that one is a cabbage as a salad green, and it really just, the balsamic is rich and just can kind of soak into that cabbage.
Now, I use soup and a lot of times to raid the fridge and get rid of those, you know, there's a little bit of this left over. It's not really enough for a serving. What kind of treasures do you like to find left over in your fridge that make their way into a salad?
Well, we this is maybe not the most common thing, but we always have daikon radish in our fridge for some reason. I think just because we're CSA farmers. So radishes are that kind of go-to. When I'm cleaning out the fridge, I'm always throwing those on my salad. Mustards, if you have just a little bit of a certain kind of mustard left, if it's stone ground or Dijon or whatever, that goes really, really good in a salad dressing. It'll spruce it up. It'll make it a little more interesting. You can put yogurt into your salad dressings. Put any fruit or vegetable you have in your fridge can go onto a salad. You just have to get a little creative with it.
Do you have a favorite salad to bring to a gathering?
I do, actually. It's not one of the ones I shared with you because it's not from my blog, but there's a Martha Stewart recipe for a kale salad with a peanutty dressing. You make the dressing yourself by grinding peanuts in a food processor, adding some apple cider vinegar and a couple other elements, some oil, some red pepper flakes, and that peanutty dressing over kale with some extra peanuts thrown in, some red peppers and some carrots thrown in is my go-to favorite salad that I always am bringing to things in summer.
Where do you go? You mentioned that Martha Stewart site. Where do you go to get inspired for new salad ideas beyond the what sounds like zillion you already have?
It's usually just because we're a CSA farmer and we're getting such a kind of strange combination of produce sometimes. It's usually from that. I'll bring one of our CSA boxes home. In the spring, it'll be lettuce and scallions and radishes and asparagus. And I'll say, okay, how can I manipulate these vegetables into one cohesive salad dish? So often it's just a CSA box is where I get the majority of my inspiration. And, you know, you just play with the flavors a little bit. With that one, you would, you know, maybe shave the asparagus so it's thin and not too crunchy. And then you've got the radishes for the crunch. And spring lettuce is amazing with a really nice buttermilk ranch. So you just start to think about salads you've had and what you have in your fridge or in your CSA box, and you just start to play with it and try dressing, stick your finger in, see if it's good, adjust it a little bit. It's mostly just experimenting and playing around with the flavors I've got here in my home.
Lauren, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Lauren Rudersdorf owns and operates Raleigh's Hillside Farm outside of Evansville with her husband Kyle. She shares stories and recipes on her blog, The Leek and the Carrot. She's been talking with us about great and inspired salads. She shared some of her recipes. You can find them at WPR.org. Coming up, a new report finds that converting to renewable energy sources could create a lot of jobs in Wisconsin. We'll talk to the report's authors. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on the morning show, there's been lots of snow and freezing rain lately and a lot of road maintenance to go along with it. Kate Archer-Kent talks to a state official about how state, county, and local governments try and keep the roads clear and then takes a look at the environmental impact of using road salt. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, a recent study from the think tank COWS suggests that Wisconsin could increase energy-related jobs and keep money within the state's borders if it moved away from using fossil fuels. The study also finds that the move could improve the environment and public health in the state. Katia Speer is a senior associate at COWS, and David Abel is a postdoctoral researcher there. They co-authored a study examining the impact on the state's economy if Wisconsin moved to renewable energy. David, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
And Katia, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Katia, what was the goal behind this study?
The goal was really a thought exercise that we worked with the County of La Crosse with. So we work with the county and a number of cities and counties around the state on a number of different projects. And this was, the goal was really to see if this was possible, if to see what the benefits, the potential benefits of moving total in-state energy production would be.
And one of the starting points, David, is the idea that we have an energy spending deficit in the state. What does that mean?
Exactly. So we recognize the fact that Wisconsin relies pretty heavily on fossil fuels for a lot of our energy needs, but the state doesn't actually have any fossil fuel resources. And that means we spend about $14 billion on energy every year that leaves the state.
And Katia, as I understand the report, this isn't the roadmap for how we get from here to there, right? There's a lot of details that would have to get sorted out.
Absolutely. This report shows a lot of potential to benefit the state in both jobs, the economy, and the environment, but it does not lay out a roadmap of how we get there.
Now, David, before we get into the report, I mean, we're hearing reports that our use of solar energy, there's news out today, has gone up a little bit in the state. I think a 3% increase in solar energy jobs, if I heard the newscast right. Are you seeing steps in this direction so far?
Absolutely, and a lot of it comes from the pricing side. Solar and wind and a lot of these technologies are getting cheap on their own, and that's driving a move towards that already. What we find is that if we can continue that and push that, then we'll find even more job and economic benefits for the state.
And David, let's start with the state's energy needs. Break down our energy needs and where they come in from, the different sectors of the state.
Yeah, so basically the big sectors are transportation, residential and commercial building demand, and industry. And it's roughly about third, if you want to put it in numbers. It's a little bit different than that. But what we find is that if you can electrify some of those sectors that traditionally aren't relying on electric power, like the transportation sector, you can actually see huge efficiency gains on the order of 4 or 5 times as efficient.
And Katia, the report looks at a lot of different possible energy sources. Without digging into the numbers, to start with, what are some of the different energy sources that would be part of this homegrown energy mix?
Sure. We look at traditional renewable energy sources like wind and solar, geothermal. Those are the classic ones. David, do you want to talk to a little bit more of the details?
Yeah, wind and solar are big ones. I think you can't forget that energy efficiency really is a resource that we can invest in making our energy use more efficient and using less energy from solar and wind to begin with. There's also biomass and nuclear, some more cutting-edge technologies like enhanced geothermal or wind on Lake Michigan, for example. Mm-hmm.
Talking to Katia Speer and David Abel from the think tank COWS, looking at a new report on the possible impacts on the state's economy of switching from using fossil fuels brought in from out of state to homegrown alternative energy sources. Katia, let's talk about jobs now. Can you talk about the kind of jobs, the hopes that you would have for job creation in a conversion like this?
Yes. So, Wisconsin is right now, one of the big takeaways is we're spending a lot of money on importing this fuel, right? So the key here is to transition to in-state resources so that we can bring those jobs and those benefits of those jobs back to the state of Wisconsin.
And David, can you talk about job numbers? And looking into your report, it looks like it's kind of complicated to figure this out and people have different ways of estimating it. That said, what kind of things did you see?
Yeah, it's complicated to do this sort of calculation, but what we see is regardless of which method you use, you're going to see an increase in jobs if we produce our energy from sources that we have in-state. What we find is that it's about a doubling of jobs. There are roughly 150,000 jobs in energy right now in the state, and we see an increase of about 160,000.
And what are some of the sectors of energy production that you would be looking at jobs in? What we hear a lot about is the idea of utility-grade solar. Is that a big part of where those jobs might come from?
A lot of that would come in solar, yeah. Wind is another big piece. Wisconsin already is a leader in the country in energy efficiency jobs, and we'd expect that to grow as well.
And part of the, I guess, concept here, Katia, is people often think of jobs versus the environment. Are you partly trying to make the case here that alternative energy sources give a little bit of both benefits?
Yeah, I think that this report really shows that the trade-off between jobs and the environment and between the economy and clean energy jobs just isn't real. The other piece of this, right, is that to really realize the potential talked about in this report, that we really need good federal, state, and local government policies to create and incentivize the renewable energy options that will create the demand for those jobs.
And do you see movements toward those kind of policies at the state or local level in particular?
Yeah, my work focuses primarily with cities in Wisconsin and around the country. And I have to say that one of the big takeaways for me is that when we talk to local governments in and outside the state, this is not a partisan issue, right? This is a jobs issue. This is an economy issue, sometimes an environmental issue, but it's not a partisan issue.
And let's talk about some of the environmental and public health benefits. You do touch on those in the report some, David. What kind of things do you look at?
Absolutely. So the big things that we look at are emissions, and that's emissions in two cents. One is greenhouse gases and climate change, but that actually turns out to be a small factor compared to air pollution. A lot of fossil fuels, when you burn them, they release a lot of different bad things into the air. A lot of them are horrible to breathe. So it turns out getting rid of them can save something like, I'll pull out a number really quick, 1,900 lives per year, 35,000 almost cases of asthma, 148,000 work loss days a year, all of those public health benefits just come from not breathing in some of the harmful pollution that comes from burning things.
And Katia, as you talk to people at the local level, is there a reaction like, okay, yes, these things all sound lovely, but the initial investment, the difficulty of going from where we are to there, does it stand out as a big roadblock?
I don't think that it's harder than sticking with business as usual, and I think that people recognize that in local governments and residents from around the state.
Can you talk about some communities you've talked to or worked with who are taking interesting efforts along these lines?
Yeah, well, we know that right here in Madison, they're passing a renewable energy policy. Also, in our work at COWS, we work closely with cities and counties around the state through the Green Tier Legacy Community Network, which is a coalition of Wisconsin local governments focused on sustainability, led by the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. And there we really we're hearing some great leadership out of places like Eau Claire, Sheboygan, La Crosse. Really a myriad of places around the state.
And David, at the national level, there's this new program or this resolution introduced by some Democrats called the Green New Deal. Details, the fine print isn't really out there yet, but looking at it, what do you see?
I see a recognition that perhaps there are a lot of win-win solutions where we can actually benefit the economy while also focusing on things that would be considered green and have often had that maybe a negative stigma associated with them. And I think if it focuses on these win-win solutions like we're trying to outline, then it would be a boon for Wisconsin and the people of the U.S. in general.
We're talking to Katia Speer and David Abel from the think tank COWS. They're with us to look at a study they co-authored exploring the impact on the state's economy and job scene, as well as public health and environment, if Wisconsin moved to renewable energy instead of importing fossil fuels from out of state. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guests about their report? What do you think about what you're hearing? And do you see in your community efforts to make the switch, at least in part, from fossil fuels to renewable energy? What does that look like in your town? Is this something you're doing maybe on your rooftop right now? Or do you work in an energy-related job? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our look at a new report on the potential impact of renewable energy on Wisconsin's economy. Katia Speer and David Abel are the co-authors of the report from the think tank COWS. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see your local community, the state as a whole, move more toward renewable energy, more away from fossil fuels? What would you like to see happen? Are you seeing this happen where you live? And how is it affecting your local economy? Do you work in an energy field right now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. To your calls now, Doug is with us in Haywood. Doug, hi.
Hello.
Hi, what did you want to bring up, Doug?
Well, just a general comment that I have on reducing our carbon footprint and addressing climate change is that I think in some regards the people who would tend to be leaders, higher profile people and so on, do more talking the talk and walking the walk. And by that I mean you can hear people talk about being excited about changing their lights to LEDs and so forth, and yet we're still using way more electricity for air conditioning than the rest of the world. I heard a report recently, we got 5% of the population, and yet in the United States, we use 40% of the world's air conditioning.
Doug, thanks for the call. Doug saying maybe we need to change our personal attitudes to do things like more energy conservation. Katia?
I mean, I think it also speaks to the need for good public policy on these things, right? Because the state and local governments can lead by example through things like greening our fleets, passing policies, smart growth policies, and land use practices that focus on infill and density. So I think a lot of times we focus at the individual level when a lot of that leadership needs to come from the state and local governments.
Doug, thanks a lot for that call. We'll go next to Paul with us in Lincoln County. Paul, hello.
Good afternoon. The local government is kind of right up my alley. I'm a county board supervisor here in Lincoln County. There are some of us who have been trying to figure out how to put some solar apparatus on county-owned buildings, partly for the energy saving itself, partly as a demonstration project. But we are continually stymied by the lack of funds. That is to say, we can't raise our levy limits because of what the legislature has done, and the state has no programs to assist local government in the installation of such solar apparatus. So we're kind of confronted with this do-nothing, think-nothing lethargy in regard to climate change and alternative energy, and it's a really hard box to get out of.
Paul, thanks a lot for the call. And Katya, this sounds like it's part of what you've worked on with local governments, or either of you can tackle this. What kind of incentives might help a situation like Paul in Lincoln County there?
Well, I'll jump in with this just to say that this is why in the report we did it as sort of a goal-setting exercise. Instead of trying to prescribe a pathway to actually doing this, and that any steps that we can take would be beneficial. We've got a long way to go before we're 100% reliant on in-state energy. But any steps that could be made, such as putting solar panels on county buildings, would help us get there. And again, it relies on some of these policies and procedures being in place to actually make that happen. So we've talked about a lot of different structures that are possible, but don't really advocate for any of them in particular. And if you would like some advice or possibly talking more about this, feel free to reach out to us. But unfortunately, nothing more specific than that now.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking about renewable energy in Wisconsin. Our guests are Katya Speer and David Abel from the group COWS, talking about a new report on the potential economic benefits of switching from fossil fuels to locally produced alternative energy sources here in Wisconsin. We'll go next to Alfred in Oconomowoc. Alfred, hello.
Hello. I'm so glad you guys are getting the word out. I work with a solar installer that's in 23 states, and I work with homeowners to put solar on their roofs. And a couple of quick comments. One, we are seeing increases in renewable in the state, about a 30% increase in the past year alone. Our state does not have a incentive program, as probably has been discussed, as compared to other states. And the main challenge for a homeowner wanting to do this on their own is the perception of how long does it cost to pay it off. And they don't ask that question, or no one asks that question, about anything other than solar, in my experience. But in either case, the people that are installing solar have a stewardship to the world, and that's part of their green dynamic in deciding. The other green is the money side of things. There are states that, as a state itself, provide incentives. In Massachusetts, for example, and I think that program is sunsetting because they've had such dramatic growth, the state gave you money over a 10-year period, so in effect, in 10 years, you were net neutral. And the purpose of doing that, obviously, is to deal with carbon and the climate change from that. So my hope is that people will rise up and work with the state to get it, you know, better going forward.
Alfred, thanks a lot for your call. Katya, can guidance from at the state level, in this case, as Alfred is talking about, make a difference in something like whether people are putting up solar panels?
I think state leadership is key here, but so are, he brings up a good point about taking advantage of financing tools and creative financing tools. I think that we can do a better job at the local, county, and state level for that. So one example that is available here in the state of Wisconsin to Wisconsin counties is PACE financing, or property assessed clean energy financing, that helps businesses pay for some of those upfront costs.
Thanks a lot for calling in and sharing your experience. David, I want to talk about some of the different sources out there. In your report, you break down the utility type solar and then the rooftop solar we were just hearing about. Also, when it comes to wind, people think wind farms, you see those on land. You also look at the potential for offshore wind in Wisconsin. Do we even have any of that now?
Yeah, absolutely. We do not have any yet. And actually, one of the big barriers is how do we get the equipment that is large enough to install these things into the Great Lakes. But the National Renewable Energy Lab, and they do a lot, they're part of the Department of Energy, they assess all of these technologies every few years, and they assess that Wisconsin has a huge potential, technical potential for the technology.
Right, and you look at national reports, and there are people out there grading us in some ways on the potential for all these different kinds of energy, the solar, the wind, and some of the other ones you've talked about. We have a lot of untapped potential, it sounds like.
Absolutely. If I remember the numbers correctly, it's something like 30 times the amount of energy we use right now is what we actually have the potential for, using only in-state sources.
And Katia, we've mentioned a couple times energy conservation ultimately as an energy source or lowering the demand, however you want to do the math. Is that another place where you see untapped potential in Wisconsin?
I think that it's an endless source of untapped potential. I think we've done a lot of work on energy efficiency over the years, but I think that there's always opportunities to do more at the individual, business, and local government level. I think there's a lot of opportunity there.
David, we've just got a few minutes left, and I want to start getting to some final points here. Is there anything else in the report that you're hoping people are paying attention to, apart from what we've already touched on?
You know, I hope people pay attention to just the fact that this is a win-win, and it was meant to kind of describe this problem that we spend $14 billion that leave the state and come up with a solution that really benefits the economy and the people and the environment of Wisconsin.
And Katia, who are you hoping takes this report and runs with it one way or another?
I think there's a lot to learn for everybody coming out of this report. And the big takeaway for me here is that, again, this doesn't have to be a fight or a trade-off between jobs and the environment or between the economy and the environment. The numbers here in this report make a good case that we can do both. And now it's up to our elected officials at the state and the local level to pass really informed policies that promote energy efficiency and renewable energy while focusing on that component of equity and making sure that the benefits of green jobs and opportunities to live in healthy communities benefit all Wisconsinites.
And David, having done this report, what are the gaps? What are the next studies you'd like to see, whether you're the one doing them or somebody else, when it comes to renewables in the state?
Well, I think the obvious question is, how do we get there, right? So that's the one thing I would like to see is, again, see leadership take up some first steps and present some options, and we'd be happy to help come up with that list. But the second thing I think is, from a more academic standpoint, is an integration study to say, how does this all work together and how does it fit within the entire eastern U.S.'s existing grid? And is what we present actually doable and possible, and on what time frame?
And Katia, do you see a movement? Again, you work with people in local communities around the country. Do you see people getting more excited about the potential for renewables?
Absolutely. As the cost comes down, both at the individual, business, and state and local policy scale, people are getting really excited about the opportunities.
We'll leave it there for now. Katia, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And David, thanks for coming up.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Katia Speer, senior associate at the think tank COWS. David Abel is with us, postdoctoral researcher at COWS. We've been talking about a new report from the group that they worked on. It examines the impact on Wisconsin's economy if Wisconsin were to move to renewable energy instead of bringing out-of-state fossil fuels into Wisconsin. Still time for you to weigh in with your thoughts, or maybe, as some of our callers did, your own experiences if you work in the alternative energy field. You can email ideas at WPR.org. You can always post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll get the latest news on efforts to prevent another federal government shutdown in our weekly roundup of national politics. Looks like a nail-biter, a provisional deal agreed to as of this point. Still questions about getting the votes for it and the signature of the president. We'll check in on the latest. We'll take a look at teacher morale here in Wisconsin and concerns about schools having trouble finding enough teachers. Our guest says there is a solution to the teacher shortage problem, and we're not really tackling that problem seriously. And meet an 11-year-old from La Crosse who's making a big splash in the world of crochet. Find out how he got hooked on the craft and now sells his creations to raise money for nonprofits. That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show. Tomorrow at 6, Valentine's Day is Thursday. First, it's Galentine's Day, celebrating the power of friendships among women. Kate Archer-Kent talks to the author of the book Girl Talk, What Science Can Tell Us About Female Friendships. That's tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then our guest says welfare programs often discourage work. We'll hear his solution for rewarding work without saying goodbye to compassion. He says Wisconsin should experiment with a universal basic income program. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time on the Ideas Network.